Post-Harlan Monologics. Number 00030. Recorded on March 19, 2023. Production location, Post. Harlan. Texas. Chapter 30.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised. Trigger warning. This series deals with topics that may be disturbing. Subject matter may include domestic violence, sexual abuse, and subsequent mental health disorders. If you are sensitive to such material, consider entertainment alternatives.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88.
Now, grunge itself, right? You think of grunge, what do you think of besides that era of time? I mean, before, like everything else that I mentioned existed before there was grunge, right? Burnouts even was grunge before there was grunge. Before there was a grunge movement, there was a grunge word. Where did grunge get the word to go to grunge from, right? Grunge means filth. And depending on you and how deeply you look into filth, see, I am the Dwayne Schneider of Post Harlan, Texas, and I live my life looking up the asshole of society 8 hours a fucking day, as you know by now. Grunge is something I'm intimately familiar with, right? Now, a dictionary definition of grunge might say something on the lines of filth, dirt. Okay, I think those are necessary ingredients to the entire composition of grunge. Grunge is that shit that don't go away, all right? Grunge is dirt, grunge is filth, grunge is syrupy, grunge is ghost turds and spooge, and grunge is all kinds of funky fucking chemical food that fell off the fucking table and ended up in the corner, and it all got coagulated into this one unnamed element that's generally regarded to or referred to as grunge. It's all kinds of filth into one, but it has to be sticky, and it has to be fungal, and you know, molded, and like you'd catch something if you touched it, right? Grunge is nasty. It's the nastiest of the nasty. I could keep on going and going, but I think you get the idea, all right? That's what grunge is. So you had a scene, fashion, a movement, a cultural movement, a musical genre, all this stuff named after that. You know, that lost a semblance of gooey filth that dried up in a corner that hasn't seen the light of day in 5 years or more, because that's where you got your fucking heavy bedroom dresser or something. You know, that's where you got your gun safe bolted to the floor. You know, shit gets behind that. That's every 5 years or so, maybe. Did you see what got behind there? That's what grunge is. You know, so it's not just the filthiness aspect of it. It's also the hidden in the shadows, lost behind stuff aspect of it. Right? And here is the irony. This is an artistic perspective I'm laying on you. This is the chiaroscuro of it all. Grunge is the darkness. It's this shit that blooms in the dark, little by little, over time, slowly, never sees the light of day. And then the grunge era, all of a sudden, is the cleaning lady that comes in the room and starts moving the furniture around, turns the fucking light on, and shines a spotlight on it. You have that darkness with that sudden light. And it's the same shock value, I think, that hit so many of these grunge musicians when the fame came. They had doubts. They had questions, you know. Everybody, you know, anybody who's a rock musician knows the Crossroads stories. And I bring it up here all the time. Robert Johnson out on the fucking Delta has a devil tune his guitar in exchange for his soul. And now he's got this ability to play this music and make these songs that make the women go crazy. And he can have anything he wants. The fame, the fortune, the glory, the women, the whiskey, everything, right? All in exchange for the soul. Seeing what happens here. Now, these guys down on the grunge scene in Seattle weren't exactly your Bible-toting Christians. But they had their own ethics, right? The punk ethos. And they would abide by that. And a lot of that was, you know, the idea of keeping everything minimalistic, low-key, being authentic, being true and genuine to your craft and the word within it. And, you know, then the fame comes, and what happens is you lose control of your artistic license, basically, right? They use the word sellout. You take money from the big labels and you get all this stuff, this fame, the fortune, you know, wealth. You'll never have to worry for nothing again, want for anything else again. But they now own you. They dictate what you're going to do. You present them a song and they don't like the words, they'll change the words for you. You show up for a concert wearing these clothes, they're going to tell you to put this on instead. And you got to do it. You become a kiss ass, a sellout, and it's the biggest mockery of anybody involved with punk communities, involved with grunge communities, you know, as they were back in the day. Right, the whole sellout thing. And fame was the result of selling out. So all these guys, they had to try to reckon this stuff out. And at the same time, they're young, all right? They're all like in their early 20s when this is happening, early to mid-20s. And because they're stoners, their development's a little bit later also in terms of responsibility and shit like that. They were basically kids, you know, of adult age, but basically kids. And, you know, it's the old story, really. When it comes to fame and rock and roll musicians, fame and athletes, right? You know, anybody who's young and comes to fame and wealth all of a sudden, they have their struggles. Well, these struggles were coming out in grunge music, of course. So it's just interesting. The word grunge really was representative of that culture as it was. It really was, you know. And I feel a part of it, not part of the Seattle scene or anything like that. And obviously removed because I was clean and sober through the whole thing. My experience of the grunge era was in the rooms of AA, you know. Which can't be totally discounted because we're all burnouts and that's where burnouts end up, right? And of course, like I mentioned before, guys like Layne Staley singing about recovery topics. That was a real part of the grunge era. I probably should have had that on the list too. But I guess it comes natural with drug abuse, drug addiction, you know. that there will actually be periods of recovery interlaced in your life there, and even in song lyrics from time to time. So yeah, grunge is filth, grunge is dirt, you know, and other distinctions of the grunge era. And again, another one that did not just evolve naturally, organically out of that moment in time, right? Vernacular, right? The word radical. Suddenly everything was fucking radical. Oh, rad, dude. It was rad and radical. Radical this, radical that. Everything was fucking radical all the time. And it stayed that way for like 15, 20 years too, you know? Because it went into the post-grunge era, and then it ended up like in the youth groups and the churches, you know? Everybody was like trying to keep up with it. Everybody was trying to be cool with the kids, right? So rad, man, that's rad. Ooh, that's rad. You know, you're radical. You're radical in your faith. And oh, man. Man, oh, man, oh, man, oh, man. Oh, man. But yeah, radical everything. And I say that was not, you know, radical is obviously a word that predates the grunge era. But as a use, you know, in vernacular, as an adjective, as a descriptor for anything that is just like pleasing in general, you know. I knew kids in junior high who spoke like that. They were into like surfing and skiing, right? It came out of that culture. I think it came out of California, out of the surfing scene, ultimately, right? And then maybe in Colorado with the skiing. And then the very well-to-do amongst us in New Jersey rubbed elbows with that shit. And then, you know, we'll bring it on home. Bring it on home. It didn't exactly catch in and amongst the people who were into skiing and surfing. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it was there. It was there. But then in the grunge era, everybody was saying radical, 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 radical. So it was radical everything in the vernacular. And then in the appearance of shit, right? The art form, distressed. Distressed everything. Everything had to be distressed. Because, and here is probably something that did actually evolve organically out of the grunge scene. Although it can be said it probably more likely comes out of like punk rock out of New York City in the 70s, right? But the idea distressed everything. I think the punk rock scene, New York, CBGBs, you had distressed pretty much everything, as I think of it through. I mean, what can be distressed? What was distressed in the grunge era, right? The clothing, right? All of a sudden, you were going to the store to buy clothes that were already previously ripped and worn down for you, right? you were buying defective clothes and actually paying the extra money for it for somebody to have defected them for you. That became a thing. I laugh at that. I wear jeans, I wear them to death, and they wear out, they get holes, and that's organic. And if you like the look of that, well, more power to you. Check me out, right? But then it became like a production item, which evolved organically out of street kids, right? Street musicians, low-life grunge, burnout motherfuckers, who were wearing the same clothes all the time. That's part of the filthy lifestyle of it all, right? You're on drugs. You're nodding off. I'm on a mini tour somewhere. You don't change your fucking clothes. You don't have the clothes to change, you know? The movement wasn't strictly the musicians, but what about the people that went to the bars? What about the guys who hung out, lived under the bridge? They were heroin addicts that got into the clubs at night and watched Soundgarden rip off some tunes, you know? I don't mean steal, but like just play them, rip out, whatever. Homeless community. You got the clothes on your back, right? That's a part of it. The filth. You don't get to wash yourself. That's a part of it. The drug addiction, all this shit, right? So the grunge people who were on the scene in Seattle had a tendency to have jeans that were all tore up and wore out, discolored and shit, you know? Filthy. And so now everybody wants to emulate the style by getting a pair of jeans, cutting holes in it, you know, shit like that. The distressed look, in addition, where blue jeans are concerned, actually predated the grunge era just by a couple of years. You know, you're going back into, you know, the Married with the Children and Guns N' Roses, like I talked about before, and then the Roseanne come on TV. The late 80s, you started having styles that involved, like, stonewashing jeans and acid washing jeans. You were doing shit to the material by these different means as part of their, like, a post-production of the blue jeans that made them kind of look distressed. I thought it kind of looked stupid personally myself, but it was the style at the time, and you could hardly get a pair of blue jeans that weren't done in like that, at least to some degree, you know. It was stupid, but, you know, the late 80s, and, you know, if you bought your blue jeans in 1989 and you wore them on the street, you know, for fucking the next 2-3 years, you're in the grunge era with acid wash, stone wash blue jeans, right? But that, the whole distressed look, it was there. Once upon a time, it was organic. It just happened. By lifestyle and the wear and tear that comes with it. And then all of a sudden, now it was like a commercial marketing effort. You were actually making bad clothes. And people were buying them, paying extra money. Nice, right? So distressed everything, you know. But it wasn't just like the clothing. Everything was distressed, right? The artwork. Think of the artwork, right? Artwork that related to like the grunge era, punk era, punk times, punk artwork. It's all distressed in its own sort of way, and a lot of it comes from just like the clubs that they played in, the alleyways at the buildings, old brick buildings with peeling paint on the side, and somebody would stencil in some kind of "do not park here" fucking, you know, letters, which also would start peeling off, and, you know, it would bleed over the stencil, and that was just like, I'm trying to like talk this shit out loud, with the dumpster right the fuck next to it, and the junkie laying on the ground fucking nodding off with his distressed jeans, right? But that's like a picture of the time, right? Outside the club where the people played, where the scene was, you had everything was distressed. The people were distressed. The clothing was distressed. The fucking the dumpster was distressed. It was rusting and peeling. The wall, the brick, the paint on the brick was peeling off the walls outside. It was stenciled over, and there was spray over on the stencil. And everything was distressed, distressed, distressed. And you take a snapshot of that, and look, here's a picture of Nirvana, you know, standing in front of a club that they played at. And people look at that and they see all the distressed stuff in the back, and they, oh, okay, that's what grunge is. Because, you know, everybody wants to capitalize on it, right? Oh, whatever. But it was distressed everything. Ultimately, you know, it becomes, going forward, your graphics, your fonts. You have, what, how many thousands of quote-unquote distressed fonts are there now? As a result of those days, right? And I got a bunch of them. There's no telling how many I have. Dozens, you know, easily dozens. And I like them. No, I like them. They resonate with me. I register with them. I think they express me as a person. I'm distressed. I'm a worn out, road weary kind of guy. I ain't trying to be. I just am, right? So they express me. They don't express everything in the world. And that's what's kind of funny, right? You know, distressed fonts. One in particular, right? One in particular is one called Downcome, right? The Downcome font. Now, this is what happens. I do, I used to be a web developer, web designer. And a web designer, web developer is a computer person, right? A computer professional that kind of incorporates everything there is about computing into one thing. It's sort of like grunge is itself, right? And one element of the web developer is as graphic artist. You have to know your Photoshop and shit like that. And because it's marketing is what you're doing, and graphic arts go with marketing, right? Commercial art is marketing. It's literally the art for marketing, right? And so you need to know something about it. You need to deal with it somehow in some way. So I would, you know, in my days doing that, and currently I do my own website, and I find cause every here and there to do some kind of graphic design. I start going through the list of fonts, right? I have some text, I have an image, and I lay the text on, and I don't really know exactly what font I want to use, and I start going through my fucking 2,000 fonts, right, from A down, and in alphabetical order. I somewhat quickly get into the D's, and in the D's there's this distressed font called Downcome, and every time I see it, I'm like, that's the font. You know, not, you know, I was saying before, distress fonts, they resonate with me, but this is the particular font that, like, is me, that expresses me, that is the font, that says Maverick 88 on it, right? So every time I see it, I automatically think, that's a cool font, and I'm going to use this shit here, and then when I go to use it, it don't work. All the websites I did, you know, you're doing websites for kids dentists, and the divorce lawyer, and a plumber, you're doing websites for maybe a small college or in the city. I did websites for all kinds of businesses, right? And somehow in my mind, I always reckoned that I could do something to kind of grungify their website, and it never really worked. It never fit. And I'm honest with myself about that. I'm really particular about these things, right? And nah, it was a no-go. It was always a no-go. Downcome was like my favorite font, and I could never find a place for it. Never find a fucking place for it. That's funny, the Downcome font, right? And the Downcome is weird because, like, it's a word. Like, you ever hear anybody say Downcome before today? Unless you know that font. It's not a widely used word by any stretch of the imagination. Downcome, right? It's not even on my dictionary app. I had to go outside that. What a downcome is, it's an iron making term, okay? So you get out the bellows and you go make yourself some iron, right? Iron making, it's a pipe that leads combustible gases downward from the top of a blast furnace to the hot blast stoves and boilers, etc., where they are burned. All right, so you're leading combustible gases away as a safety precaution, I guess, to somewhere they can be ignited and burned off. And this may come up again later in our little topic of conversation here. But yeah, downcome. You know, now there is also a use of it relating to, like, tumbling, falling down, overthrow, ruin, destruction, right? And then also with that, probably if you're like me, you think the same thing. You think down come, and then you think, well, how about come down? Is that like one and the same? Well, yes, it can be one and the same, as it turns out. As a verb, come down come is to come down, right? Fall down, come or fall apart. So down come, come down, down come, come down, which is now, see, come down in this regard has its own definitions. It's not just a matter of, like, being up and then going down from somewhere specifically, like those combustible gases in the downcome pipe were. Though, of course, so much of what I'm speaking to in this monologue is the realm of the burnout. In that realm, your come down is when your drug-induced euphoric high dissipates. That's the come down, right? And depending on what drugs you're on and how many of them there are and how you've mixed them and matched them, it could be a horrible thing. It's never a great thing, you know? You went from high to low one way or another. That sucks. So come down is a negative term for the burnout community, the stoner community. In it, right around these times that we're talking about, right? You had the, I talk about the grunge era being like the first half of the 90s. Right at that middle point, it gets a little weird. There's a transition happening, right? I mentioned post-grunge. I mentioned how it's kind of the engineering is a higher quality. It's very cleaned up, more presentable, marketable type of music of the same genre, right? At the same era of time. But it was different, not only in that regard, but particularly in that regard. One of who is known as the predominant post-grunge bands was a band out of England called Bush, whose masterwork was an LP called 16 Stone in 1995, right? And they had a lot of great songs on it, a lot of airplay, a lot of radio tunes, you know, hits, I guess you'd call them. I don't know if they were still being called hits at that point. But Come Down was one of those songs, right? There was a song called Come Down. And to me, that was the best one of them. Of all their best shit, Come Down was the best. And Come Down, you know, as a lyrical theme, seems to have sort of a double meaning to it, right? There seems to be the sense of a come down from the loss of a relationship or a broken romance, and the depression, grief, sorrow that comes with that loss is a come down. And then the response to that is to like boot up some heroin, be lifted euphorically back up to a place where you really don't give a shit. And then you come down off of that again, and now you got like a double come down. You see what I'm saying? It's like a double suck. And that song seems to be kind of wrapped around that double suck idea of coming down. Really good song, really good album. Bush got bagged a whole lot by critics and shit who were punk and grunge aficionados, fucking snobs, really. I call it grunge snobbery. There was a whole bunch of that. These days, they just kind of morphed naturally in the direction they were going. I talk about this struggle that the grunge musicians had, leaving their indie lifestyle and transitioning into this fame and fortune. But they did it. It's not that they didn't fucking do it. They did it. For the most part, the ones you've ever heard of, they did it. They went ahead and did it. And when they went ahead and did it, guess what? Their records were being engineered just as technically proficiently as the post-grunge bands would be, too. So there was a total fucking obvious graduation through the years, what was going on. There was a lead up to something that regrettably never appeared, right? What started with grunge and went into post-grunge just faded into nothing. So really, yeah, post-grunge might have been a come down from grunge, really. I think a lot of people were apt to, a lot of very important people in high places in this world, not that burnout cultures are that important or anything like that, but it was so prevalent in culture in general that it was probably starting to irk some people. The idea of all these kids being all fucked up by the shit that the parents did. Guess who the parents were, right? Parents were the record executives. They were the television executives. They were the politicians, right? You see where I'm getting at? The generation before that made these grunge era kids and young adults as fucked up as they were, They were responsible for that shit. So when they see this shit thrown at them continually, I think there was a desire among some people to kind of, let's start putting that shit back in the closet where it belongs. Let's just sweep it back under the rug or into the corner with all the rest of the fucking grunge, right? Who could know? But it just seemed that way. Because, the post-grunge years seemed to co-op the grunge years, and then they just dissipated into nothingness. They didn't graduate into the next thing. They just died. It just went away. All was gone. See what I'm saying? So, but still, a lot of great music came out of post-grunge era with post-grunge bands. A lot of the grunge era musicians ended up in post-grunge bands, or at least their bands kept on going through the post-grunge era, right? Not everybody stopped when Kurt Cobain died, and we'll get into that. We'll get into that shortly. So yeah, grunge snobbery. Snobbery. It's a funny thing. It's an ironic thing, right? Because it's like the domain of the filthy. I don't know how you'd be snobbery about that, but there's particularities, and I guess that we as people, we have this sense of like being at the core of and at the height of some social structure, right? It reminds me of like when somebody dies. When somebody dies, everybody all of a sudden was the best friend to that person. Well, when grunge died, all of a sudden everybody was the best friend to grunge, right? So you had the grunge snobbery started. And I don't know that that's a term. I know that that's probably something that belongs in the Maverick 88 dictionary. It's something I made up as far as I know. But yeah, grunge snobbery is like people who laying down the parameters for what qualifies as true, authentic grunge culture and what doesn't, right? I'm talking about this stuff, but I'm not making rules. I'm just making observations. But there are people that are really particular about this shit. I was there, that kind of stuff. Now, usually the snobs are like music critics. I think I mentioned that earlier before. But when I think specifically of the grunge era, and I don't mean to bemoan this person. I don't. I really don't. I think of like the queen of grunge as being Courtney Love. Who else would it be, really? Right? Courtney Love, of course, is the significant other of Kurt Cobain, who's probably the king of grunge, I guess. That's a little disputable, but Courtney Love as queen? Nah, because A, she was on the scene, B, she was a loudmouth and a pop culture figure. What else? D, she's also, she was leading a band, right? A band of girls, a literal grunge band out of Seattle at the time, you know? So who else? Who else would be the queen of grunge other than Courtney Love? And so when I think of grunge snobbery and who like lays down the dictates for what is grunge and what isn't grunge, I look at her as the face on grunge snobbery. Not to say that she's a grunge snob, just that she's the rightful face on that attitude. Right? Follow me? So I mean, I'm not trying to bewail this person in particular, right? Now, of course, like I said, she was the significant other of Kurt Cobain, and it was Kurt Cobain, singer, guitar player in Nirvana, who died young, right? Died early in... It is reckoned that his death signified the end of the grunge era. And his death happened in April of 94, right? 94, which was, in my lifetime, there's probably three ridiculously great years of music. It was 69, 79, and 94. And since 94, nothing. Nothing. Right? And this is in rock music particularly. 1994 was incredible, right? Everybody let out some of their best music at that time. But right at the beginning of it, Kurt Cobain died, right? Just 3-4 months into it. And he died. And that's identified as like the end of the grunge era. And then from that point forward, it was a transition into the post-grunge, which I said earlier, transitioned into absolutely nothing. So, and if that's not enough, the kicker, you know, as far as Courtney Love being kind of in the middle of this and being like the female face of the grunge scene and the grunge era, now, her band, Hole, had a bass player, Kristen Pfaff, who OD'd on heroin, I think, and died, right? Just like a month and a half after Kurt Cobain died, something like that, a month or two. And Courtney Love was integrally connected to the two deaths that were at the end of the grunge era. Which, of course, you know, quickly, if you do your math right quick, might make you a little suspicious. And, as it turns out, from that time forward, there was a lot of suspicion. There was a lot of mystery and intrigue, a lot of conspiracy theories that were kind of pointing to the idea that Courtney Love worked in cahoots with all kinds of people. It would have required all kinds of people, city officials and shit like that, like the police, the coroners and everything, to kill off Kurt Cobain, you know, for whatever simple selfish reason a person might have to do something like that for. And you know, it's a tough thing to talk about that. That's why I'm kind of like hesitating here. It's like, on the one hand, she was I don't know how she is. She came off at the time as a very abrasive person, which really fit the whole moniker of grunge, right? Very abrasive person. And to me, that's an unattractive quality in anybody, but in particularly a woman, right? A woman with the feminine grace and everything like that. Abrasiveness is completely on the other side of the spectrum. That would be more of a masculine quality as far as I'm concerned. And not that it matters. It's just she was an abrasive person to me, and I just couldn't get with that. And when I think of these conspiracy theories that rose up and evolved involving her plotting the death of Kurt Cobain, it's almost like where there's smoke, there's fire. You could see in her attitude a potential for something like that at some level. And this sucks to say because this is a famous person who I don't know personally, right? You gather this stuff from what you gather through the news and, you know, other hearsay and shit like that, documentary, whatever. None of any of this is fair. That's what I said. I don't mean to be moaning, but little. The truth of the matter, probably, what I'm leaning to is that no, that it didn't happen that way. Or if it happened anything like that, there was a cover-up involved, right? But not of a conspiracy, not a planned murder. Like there was an accidental death that was covered up. Something like that. It could have been like an OD or some shit like that that was just covered up. But, you know, more realistically speaking, that is somebody who was very close to somebody who died. And that's a fucking scar that'll never be ironed out of our heart, right? And so it's more fair to express it in that regard. But it was there, and it was a part of, call it post-grunge culture, right? The end of the culture era, Kurt Cobain dying, add the exclamation point of Kristen Pfaff dying soon thereafter. Everybody, you know, both from the right in the heart of the Seattle grunge scene, the end of the era, and then you go into the post-grunge era and what starts to evolve out of that. Well, grunge snobbery for one thing, and then this idea that there was a conspiracy to have Kurt Cobain killed, right? Kurt Cobain and Kristen Pfaff alike, and me alike, were all born in 1967. See, these would be my contemporaries. That's what I'm saying. I missed out being clean and sober on the whole grunge scene. That would have been my place to be. That would have been my place to be in my 20s, right? A little too old to rock and roll, you know. Technically, as far as I'm concerned, it's another story, another issue. But what was going on in the early 90s, that should have been my place, you know, where I was old enough to be in the bars and getting drunk, right? Should have been my scene, but when I hit 30, I should have been mature enough to let it go. Also, because there was a younger edition of Generation X that were in high school at the time, right? The world was handed off to them and then forward. But anyway, both of these people were born, like me, in 1967. And that, when you do the math, makes them both 27 years old. And puts them both in the infamous 27 Club. Right? The 27 Club. What's that? That is a long list of entertainers, famous entertainers generally, that throughout known entertainment history died at the age of 27 for one reason or another. Right? In that case, you had a suicide by shotgun and a overdose. And other cases were other cases, you know. Just like the end of the grunge era was kind of signified by the death of a 27-year-old musician. Really, two 27-year-old musicians dying. The same thing happened with the hippie era at the end of the 60s into the early 70s. It come to a halt, according to some people anyway, with the deaths of Jimi Hendrix, who was 27, Jim Morrison, who was 27, and Janis Joplin, who was 27. All three are supposed to have OD'd. Morrison's death was always kind of sketchy. People, another conspiracy theory, you know, in the 27 Club was, did he really die? Was it a staged death? It may have been. It may have been. He probably had all the connections to get that shit done, but who knows, you know, who knows? Who knows? But also in the 27 Club would end up being his significant other also, a couple years down the road, right? She ended up OD'ing on heroin also. Go figure, right? I told you, heroin wasn't just invented in the grunge era. It goes all the way back. So the end of the hippie era came with the death of three 27-year-olds all in the 27 Club, Hendrix, Morrison, and Joplin, right? And you think about it, like the music that never happened as a result of these people dying. And, you know, what about the music that might have happened even while they were alive that really didn't? You know, could they have gotten together and jammed out and made music together? You know, in fact, if there was an instance with Hendrix and Morrison where that actually did happen, but it turned out to be not so much music. They did a song together called Morrison's Lament. Now, this was not penned out note by note. This was a jam session, basically. All right? What happened was, there's a whole recording, a whole album of it, and one of my buddies, when we were burnouts back in the early 80s, got his hands on it, right? We thought of it at the time as just a pirated album, and apparently it exists even still, but we had it, and it was very poor quality. And it was Jimi Hendrix, right? It was called Jimi Hendrix Woke Up This Morning and Found Myself Dead. Right? Great title. Real downer. They talk about down, come, and come down. Right? Woke up this morning and found myself dead. It was Hendrix jamming at a club called The Scene in New York in 1968, I want to say. And Yeah, he had a band behind him. It wasn't his ordinary Jimi Hendrix Experience band, but there was somebody else playing behind them, and he had a couple of people that come up and join and jam out. One of the Winter Brothers, I think, was one of the ones who were involved, and I can't think of the others. So it was kind of like this Jimi Hendrix club show, club date show in New York at the Scene in 1968, where it was kind of loose and like musicians were there observing him like they did because he was phenomenal and sensational and something whole brand new and different, right? And then they would just jump on the stage and jam with him. Well, one of the people in the crowd happened to be Jim Morrison, and he happened to be absolutely shit-faced fucking drunk. And he got up on the stage and just started like howling and moaning and speaking all kinds of filth into the microphone. So it wasn't a song, it wasn't music, it was just garbage. But it ended up on this collection of recordings from that night, and they titled it after the fact, Morrison's Lament. But I regard it as something that was just completely unlistenable. It was just garbage to me. But yeah, they did that shit together, right? I woke up this morning and found myself dead. Now, Janis Joplin, on the other hand, what do I got to say about Janis Joplin? I don't know of her jamming with those other two at all, or any of those other two jamming with her. Could have been good. Could have been good. Janis Joplin was from Texas. She's a Texan, right? She's a far way out there liberal, you know, stoned out, burned out, freaky mama. But she's a Texan, all the same, right? And the soul of those deep-hearted blues that she belts out like she does, it comes from the deepest of the deep South, you know, way down on the Gulf. Port Arthur is a oil refinery town, right near the border of Louisiana on the Gulf of Mexico, and I've been through there. And being that it's a refinery town, as it is a petroleum town, I regard it in the same light as I regard, like, Carteret, New Jersey, right? Port Arthur is like the Arthur Kill, if you know what the Arthur Kill is, of Texas, right? The Arthur Kill of Texas. The Arthur Kill is this little river, or rivulet, or I don't know what the fuck it is. It's this waterway that runs, it's the size of a river. It runs between New Jersey and Staten Island, New York, right? Richmond County, New York, one of the five boroughs of New York City. It's a very desolate kind of landscape there, not in the same way as like the plains here in Texas are featureless. I mean desolate. Like, one side of the Arthur Kill, the New York side, was the Fresh Kills landfill, the garbage dump of New York City, five boroughs, you know. That's a lot of fucking garbage, and it was huge, and it stunk, it was nasty. Everything anywhere near it was dead and intoxified, toxic. And it was just like the desolate fucking death scene and smell. And then on the other side of it, you had like a refinery area, right? And then on the Jersey side, Carteret, Linden, those were all Port Murray. Those were refinery towns. And it ran down from like on the top of Staten Island across over there. I guess that would be like Elizabeth, right? Elizabeth on down to Perth Amboy. There's a waterway the size of a river, probably a river, but it's called the Arthur Kill. Kill is a Dutch word for something. Anywhere around New York where you had Dutch settlement, you have this word kill. I just used it twice. You had the Arthur Kill, and then you had the Fresh Kills landfill. Well, Fresh Kills was a waterway at the northern part of Arthur Kill. You get up by Bayonne and shit and start bending over towards Brooklyn. You got the Fresh Kills up there. And then you've got these towns through New York and up the Hudson River that have kill in the world, like Peekskill. You've heard of Peekskill, New York, right? That's a city up there. And there's others like it too. But that's a Dutch word that means fill in the blank. I don't know. River, maybe? I don't know. But anyway, the Arthur Kill is that waterway that runs through that area. And it's, you know, between Carteret. I mentioned Carteret, New Jersey. That's a city I worked in briefly when I worked for UPS. We were at the end of one project, the one contract folded up. Our team had not been sent off to new projects yet, so we had to all team together somewhere available in the UPS system that was amenable to everybody on the project that was on the Jersey side of it. And my manager found an office space for us in Carteret. We were like 2-3 doors down from the fucking Arthur Kill, looking over at the garbage dump. It was fucking disgusting, right? A disgusting place to have to be. And that was like, how long was that? Almost 2 months of my life I had to commute over to there, right? So, yeah, we were right the fuck there. So that whole area, right, what I'm talking about, you know, I talk about the Jersey, right, that Arthur Kill area on the Jersey side. It's really like between the Arthur Kill and then over on the New Jersey Turnpike. It's a stretch of land that runs up between that that's really horrible. And then anything just near that, like on the other side of the turnpike, but nearby. In fact, that's the area, if you're familiar with the, if you got to be at least familiar with the Sopranos. The Sopranos was the most popular, how did they regard it? Most popular cable TV series like ever fucking made, and it ain't even close. It was groundbreaking in everything that it did, you know, sociologically, culturally, all this shit. But it was, you know, based on a New Jersey mob family. So the opening credits has the head mobster of the family, Tony Soprano, cruising down the turnpike, right? He gets out of the Lincoln Tunnel and he starts heading south down the turnpike. I know this area. I used to commute up and down there. Before UPS, I had a job up by the George Washington Bridge, right? So the turnpike ends before that, or, you know, right around there. So from that point down the turnpike all the way down to Route 10, or Route 10, nah, Route 10's a little north. Exit 10 on the turnpike is Interstate 287, right? One way it goes back out to Arthur Kill and Staten Island, Perth Amboy, the southern part of Staten Island. The other way it head inland to where I was living at the time was definitely Bound Brook, New Jersey, right? Bound Brook, New Jersey. But on the way, somewhere about halfway in the middle of all that, and if you're following Tony Soprano down while he's smoking his stogie driving down the turnpike, he's going through, you know, from where I said Lincoln Tunnel, so out through Secaucus and starts turning south down through Newark and from Newark down into Elizabeth. And then when he gets down by there, this is like the area of the Newark airport. They show like all these petroleum tanks, these oil tanks on the side of the road, right? You know, one of them has the words drive safely painted on the side of it. That's the area I'm talking about right there. Right? You get down there, you're into, you know, south of Elizabeth, you're into Linden, and Carteret, Rahway, that's like known as the carcinogenic capital of the free fucking world. The cancer rates in that area were stupendous, you know. It was all oil refineries, but there was even a massive fertilizer plant right over there too, I come to find out later. And that's a whole long story that ain't gonna be told anytime today. But shitty area, absolutely shitty area. But so that's it. The Sopranos opening theme, right? The Sopranos opening theme brought you right down to that area. So the Sopranos opening credits are rolling in front of music. It's the Sopranos opening theme. And the opening theme of the Sopranos is a song called Woke Up This Morning by a band called Alabama 3. At least that's what they call themselves when they're in England. They're an English band, a Brit band, right? Alabama 3. But for legal reasons, they are known in the United States as A3. Okay, so Alabama 3 or A3. Woke up this morning. I always thought the song had, the song title has something to do with the blue moon in your eyes. Is it blue moon in your eyes? I thought it was blue moon or some shit like that, or blue moon in your eyes. Yeah, it turns out it's actually woke up this morning. And Yeah, I guess the prominent line, prominent lyric in that song is, woke up this morning, got myself a gun. Do-do-do-do-do. Right? Or is it got yourself a gun? Woke up this morning, got yourself a gun. Boy, you'd think how many times I watch The Sopranos, I would know. But it's just one of those odd things that are just slippery right now for me. Woke up this morning, got myself... This morning, literally this morning, right? Yes, I got myself a gun. In fact, I got two, right? That kind of day, right? No. This is every day in Texas, right? Every day is like that. I submitted for my handgun license renewal. Got this piece of paper like 2 months ago. And, yeah. It's one of those, I'll get to it. I fucking totally forgot about it. My wife pointed out. So, I wasn't really doing all that much this morning. Kind of trying to figure life out a little bit. And getting groggy, slow off the fucking, off the ground. So I got online and I did that. I did my handgun license renewal, right? Texas is what's called a constitutional carry state. Relatively new phenomenon in the country. And here, actually, it's probably a very old one that got fucked with. And now it's starting to move back to the traditional way of doing things. It's basically... doing as much as can be done within reason to regard handguns as tools, no different than a hammer. There is no requirement here for you to have a license to carry a gun. You want to carry a gun? Fucking carry a gun. Go ahead. You can always carry long guns, rifles, shotguns. That don't matter. You go right up and down Main Street with a fucking AR. Yeah, locked and loaded. It don't matter. It's legal to do. Handguns they try to control in this country for whatever reason. I'm sure there's a reason. I don't really think much about it. I just think it's stupid. That's about as far as I go with it. But not to be on the soapbox, just trying to tell it like it is, right? It's a constitutional carry state, which means you're not required to have a license to, but the benefit of having a license, and what did it cost me? $40, right? So $40 of processing and data use and all that, whatever, you know, getting me actual card out and keeping the people who work in that department paid, you know, the state people, $40, and it's probably like another 5 years. I've renewed it a couple of times along the way. I don't remember how much time. My Tennessee one, I let expire foolishly, just let it go, but that's not a problem. That's easy enough to get if I really wanted to. I had it from when I was living there, and I could have just renewed it as out of state. And here's what I'm getting to. The benefit, even if... And Tennessee's constitutional carry also. Most of the South is, right? And a lot of the Plains is. Yeah, at least half the states are now. But the benefit to having the license is if you go out of state. See, as a Texas citizen, Texas rules apply to me. And if we're constitutional carry here, that's good and fine. But if I go up to Oklahoma, yes, they're constitutional carry, but I'm not a citizen of Oklahoma. So that might not work the same. I'm sure they're cool about it up there. But if I go to another state that isn't constitutional carry, where a permit is required, then you got problems. You got legal issues, right? So, and that may be the case like Louisiana. I don't know that Louisiana is constitutional carry, but they have what's called, oh man, I can't even say the word, reciprocity laws. Those are interstate agreements, one state to another, about the management of law as it regards citizens from out of state carrying handguns. Okay, that was a long fucking way to say all that. So when you have states that are reciprocal with your state, you having a concealed handgun license, CHL, allows you to conceal carry in their state. If they're open carry state, those laws should apply to you also, but you got to these reciprocal laws vary agreement to agreement, so you got to kind of keep abreast of it, right? You got to kind of check it out before you go traveling somewhere. But so we're constitutional carry. We don't require the handgun here, license here, but you get it because if you're going to travel out of state, it will be probably helpful for you. It helps you with the purchase of handguns. You know, you just show it to the guy where you're buying from, and they get you right in the system. You're in and out 10 minutes buying a gun, you know, whatever. That's good for that. It's got its good its purposes. It's worth having. If you come to Texas and you're not a gun person and you decide, well, maybe I should get a handgun to, you know, protect myself and protect my wife, and that's a good idea. Even though we're constitutional carry, you can go right to the sporting goods store and buy yourself a 9mm and get a box of ammo, and you're ready to go. The problem is you don't know shit. You don't know how to use a gun. You don't know the situations where it's lawful for you to use a gun, things like that. If you go for the license, you'll be required to take classes. And in those classes, you'll learn a lot of shit, a lot of good shit, right? And also, you'll have to prove your capability of handling your weapon, right? Literally target practice. But it gives people an opportunity to observe that you know how to be safe with the firearm, basically aim it, and obviously handle its functions. So, you know, that's Texas. I woke up this morning and got myself a gun permit, right? But it's totally normal here. The culture down here is totally normal. When I said I got up this morning and got myself not one gun but two, you know, I'll tell you, I keep a shotgun handy when I'm home. I keep it locked up when I'm not. The shotgun is going to be my go-to if I have an intruder. It's the way to fly. Lots of reasons. I don't think this is the place to get into it, but that's, and I always have a handgun because when I'm out of the house, that's how I keep myself protected, and that's how I defend other people who are innocent, right? So if a handgun is out, and it's basically wherever I am, it is, you know, except for work. That's a whole other fucking long story, and I don't want to get into that right now, or maybe not even ever, but that, right? All right, leave it there. But, yeah, so it's different here than it is like where I grew up in New Jersey. In New Jersey, there's a different attitude where it comes to guns. There are a lot of fear and apprehension. There's a lot of that sense like these guns are nuclear fucking bombs, right? Like the first time a New Jersey person ever holds a 9mm, they think they got the atom bomb in their hand. They got like the power to kill now. And it's like, come on, man. But that's the attitude. There's a fear. I had it. I know what I'm talking about, right? I'm not making this shit up at all. A fear of myself. I'm going to get talking about myself as we go, but I talk about myself as a burnout, and ultimately a burnout is a result of having other problems, and those other problems make you a little iffy of a person, right? If I'm walking around stoned all the time and drunk, you don't want me walking around with a gun, right? Thankfully, I'm sober for a very long period of time, and things have changed. I am a respectable member of society now. You might not respect me, but I'm respectable anyway, nonetheless. But I remember being afraid of my own damn self, is what I'm trying to say. There was most of my life, I was afraid of my own damn self, and I know that if I had a gun, and I could have had a gun, you know, it's not like in New Jersey you can't buy a handgun. You could purchase one. It may take 6 months for the paperwork to go through, but eventually you'll get it. And when you do get it, then there's a lot of rules that basically all you could do is play with it in your house, and you got to stow it a certain way to transport it to a gun range. And, you know, everything is really just covered up and controlled. But I was so afraid of myself, I wouldn't get a gun for myself. And I have conversations with people. I have friends that are not gun people, but are making this turn that I'm talking about. They're going to go get a gun. And they don't know shit about it. And I start telling them, and they start to realize, wow, there's a whole lot to this stuff. But I've heard them say, some of them, not all of them, some say that they don't trust themselves. They don't trust themselves to, like, not to get mad one day and pop off and do something stupid. All right, I could respect that. If that's how you feel about you, And if you've got the history that substantiates that notion, don't get a fucking gun. Don't. And then the only way you're going to be able to defend yourself is to try to mind your P's and Q's in polite company. And don't piss anybody else off who might pop off and be stupid, right? Respectable gun owners, responsible gun owners, are not going to be that kind of person. And there's, I was not a responsible person. I couldn't trust myself with myself for a large portion of my life. And I'd be honest with you. And I was trained in firearms. I was a Marine. I didn't trust myself in a Marine Corps. I didn't trust myself before it or after it. But I was always very proficient with weapons. I was literally a fucking Marine Corps rifle expert, right? I have a tattoo of the expert badge on me. That's my little tip of the cap to the Marine Corps forever and ever. I always loved the firearms. I didn't trust myself, right? So there's that angle of it. People that don't trust themselves. And then people who might trust themselves, who are responsible, but don't really understand enough about guns. And they get the impression that guns will grow a set of fucking legs and get up and start running around and get pissed off and start shooting people arbitrarily on its own volition, you know, without a human behind it, which is obviously bullshit too. But that's a fear factor. That's actually respect, and that's the beginning of a responsible gun owner right there, just waiting to happen. And believe me, you got a buddy who shoots guns and you don't, you're one of those types of people. If you're afraid of yourself, stay away from it. But if you're a responsible person that's afraid of the gun itself, get with a friend of yours that knows, a hunter, a police officer, something like that. Have them take you out to the range. You'll see things in a different light. And it would be good for you and everybody around you if you're a responsible person. That really matters. This was not my plan to talk about this stuff. But here we go. Woke up this morning and got myself a gun. A little bit of the backstory of that song, right? That Alabama 3 song. And I don't know the details, and I don't know if it's even a true story, but it's an idea whoever wrote the lyrics had in his head about a woman who was just fed up with the world in general, woke up and went to the store and got herself a gun. I woke up this morning, got myself a gun. It was like right on the nightstand sort of thing, you know? The shotgun propped up against the wall. This is a woman who, and I'm quoting this, quote, unquote, was fed up, unquote, and went and got herself a gun at a store. Went to a store and got herself a gun. And I don't know what the rest of the story is behind that. You can only imagine, you know? You can only imagine. You could run with that any way you want to, but what it reminds me of, see, obviously Sopranos are a mob movie, so you talk about woke up this morning, got myself a gun. What you think of in the context of the Soprano is just one of these gangsters, right? One of these mafiosos doing what he does as normal. Get up, you know? You wake up with your hangover with the cocaine on the table and the whiskey bottle half empty, and there's your fucking 9mm sitting right there, and you just grab it and you tuck it in your crotch, right? And get a move on. But no, the story is about some woman who was fed up and decided was going to go out and buy herself a gun. That story reminds me of another story. That comes from another song. And before I go down that road, I need to alert the audience, anybody listening to this, that from here forward in this series of monologues that I'm calling Downcome, there is going to be subject matter that can prove to be very disturbing to people who are sensitive with issues involving things like abuse, domestic abuse, child abuse, molestation, incest, gender issues, rape. Okay, there's some heavy topics there that are probably going to end up being touched upon as a result of where this train of thought is turning at this point going forward, okay? So this is literally a trigger warning.
The Downcome series continues in the next release of Post-Harlan Monologics.
Thank you for tuning into Post-Harlan Monologics. Please understand that this project is meant to be part of a long-term archive as a series of snapshots reflecting a distant past. We are not seeking advertisers, but may at times accept private anonymous donations to help mitigate production costs. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Harlan Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at post-harlan.com and at onsert.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@post-harlan.com.